The man passed the pub in its coat of shocking salmon pink paint and lifted his head to read the billboard above the empty car park. "Black is beautiful. Drink Guinness," it proclaimed. And the man did not smile, but lowered his head and trudged on over the bridge that divided the village in two. On the stone balustrades of the bridge, a midnight artist had used an aerosol paint can to spray political slogans in day-glow colours. "Brits out" on the left-hand balustrade, and "Stop H-block torture" on the other. This time, the man grimaced sourly. Below him, the steely grey water boiled about the stone piers before hissing down towards the sea. The man wore a cyclist's plastic cape and a narrow-brimmed tweed cap pulled down over his eyes. The wind dashed at him, flogging the skirts of the cape against his Wellington boots. He seemed to cringe to the wind, hunching down against its cold fury, as he trudged on past the few buildings of the village. The street was deserted, though the man knew that he was being watched from curtained windows. This village, on the lower slopes of the Wicklow Hills, a mere 30 miles from Dublin, would not have been his choice. Here isolation worked against them, making them conspicuous. He would have preferred the anonymity of the city. However, his preferences had never been asked for. This was only the third time he had left the house since they had arrived. Each time it had been for some emergency provision, something that a little more forethought might have prevented, which should have been included when the old house was stocked for their stay. That came from having to rely on a drinking man. But here again, he had not been consulted. He was discontented and in a truculent, smouldering mood. It had rained most of the time, and the oil-fired central heating wasn't working. The only heating was the smoking peat fires in the small fireplaces in each of the two big rooms they were using. The high ceilings and sparse furnishings had made the rooms more difficult to warm, and he had been cold ever since they had arrived. They were using only the two rooms and had left the rest of the house locked and shuttered. It was a gloomy building, with a smell of damp pervading it. He had only the company of a whining alcoholic, day after cold, rainy day. The man was ripe and overripe for trouble, for any diversion to break the grinding monotony. But now he was reduced to errand boy and house servant, roles for which he was unsuited by temperament and training, and he scowled darkly as he trudged over the bridge towards the village store, with its row of petrol pumps standing before it like sentries. The storekeeper saw him coming and called through into the back of the shop. "It's himself from down at the old manse." His wife came through, wiping her hands on her apron, a short, plump woman with bright eyes and ready tongue. "City people have no more sense than they need out in this weather. Sure, and it's not baked beans nor jamison and whiskies after buying." Speculation about the occupant of the old manse had swiftly become one of the village's main diversions, with regular bulletins broadcast by the girl on the local telephone exchange. 2 overseas telephone calls, by the postman, no mail deliveries, by the dustman. The disposals into the dustbins were made up mainly of empty Heinz baked beans cans and Jameson's whiskey bottles. "I still think he's from the trouble up north," said the shopkeeper's wife. "He's got the look and the sound of an Ulster man." "Hush, woman," her husband cautioned her. "You'll bring bad luck upon us. Get yourself back into the kitchen now." The man came in out of the rain and swept the tweed cap off his head, beating the water from it against the jamb of the door. He had black, straight hair, cut into a ragged fringe above the dark Irish visage and fierce eyes, like those of a falcon when first the leather hood is slipped. "The top of the morning to you, Mr. Barry," the shopkeeper greeted him heartily. "Like as not, it will stop raining before it clears." The man they knew as Barry grunted, and as he slipped the waterproof cape from his shoulders, swept the cluttered interior of the little general dealer's store with a quick, all-embracing glance. He wore a rough tweed jacket over a cable-stitched jersey and brown corduroys tucked into the top of the Wellington boots. "You finished writing on your book, have you?" Barry had told the milkman that he was writing a book about Ireland. The Wicklow Hills were a stronghold of the literary profession. There were a dozen prominent or eccentric writers living within 20 miles, taking advantage of Ireland's tax concessions to writers and artists. "Not yet," Barry grunted, and went across to the shelves nearest the till. He made a selection of half a dozen items and laid them on the worn countertop.
"When it's good and wrote, I'm going to ask the library to keep a copy for me," the shopkeeper promised,
as though that was exactly what a writer would want to hear, and began to ring up the purchases on his register. Barry's upper lip was still unnaturally smoother and paler than the rest of his face. He had shaved away the dark, droopy moustache the day before arriving in the village, and at the same time had cut the fringe of his hair that hung almost to his eyes. The shopkeeper picked up one of the purchases and looked inquiringly at Barry, but when the dark Irish face remained impassive and he volunteered no explanation, the shopkeeper dropped his eyes self-consciously and rang up the package with the other purchases and dropped it into a paper carrier.
"That'll be £3.20," he said,
and closed the cash drawer with a clang, waiting while Barry slung the cape over his shoulders and adjusted the tweed cap.
"God be with you, then, Mr. Barry."
There was no reply, and the shopkeeper watched him set off back across the bridge before he called his wife again.
"He's a surly one, all right, he is. He's got him a girlfriend down there."
The shopkeeper was bursting with the importance of his discovery.
"He's up to a nice little bit of hanky-panky."
"How do you know that?"
"He was after buying women's things, you know."
He hooded a knowing eye.
"No, I don't know," his wife insisted. "For the curse, you know, women's things."
And his wife glowed with the news and began to untie her apron.
"You sure now?"
she demanded.
"Would I ever be lying to you?" "I think I'll go across to Molly for a cup of tea," said his wife eagerly.
The news would make her the woman of the hour throughout the village. The man they knew as Barry trudged into the narrow, high-walled lane that led up to the old manse. It was only the heavy boots and voluminous cape that gave him a clumsy gait, for he was a lithe, lean man in prime physical condition, and under the brim of his cap the eyes were never still, hunter's eyes, probing and darting from side to side. The wall was 12 feet high, the stonework blotched with silver-grey lichen, and although it was cracked and sagging at places, yet it was still substantial and afforded complete privacy and security to the property beyond. At the end of the lane, there was a pair of rotten and warping double doors, but the lock was a bright new brass Yale, and the cracks in the wood and the gaping seams had been covered with fresh white strips of pine, so that it was impossible to see into the interior of the garage. Barry unlocked the brass Yale lock and slipped through, pulling the latch closed behind him. There was a dark blue Austin saloon car parked facing the doors for immediate departure. It had been stolen in Ulster 2 weeks before, resprayed and fitted with a roof rack to alter its appearance, and with new license plates. The engine had been tuned and checked, and Barry had paid nearly twice its market value. Now he slipped behind the wheel and turned the key in the ignition. The engine fired and caught immediately. He grunted with satisfaction. Seconds could mean the difference between success and failure, and in his life, failure and death were synonymous. He listened to the engine beat for half a minute, checking the oil pressure and fuel gauges, before switching off the engine again and going out through the rear door of the garage into the overgrown kitchen yard. The old house had the sad, unloved air of approaching dereliction. The fruit trees in the tiny orchard were sick with fungus diseases and surrounded by weed banks. The thatch roof was rotten green with moss, and the windows were blind man's eyes, unseeing and uncaring. Barry let himself in through the kitchen door and dropped his cape and cap on the scullery floor and set the carrier on the draining board of the sink. Then he reached into the cutlery drawer and brought out a pistol. It was a British officer's service pistol, had in fact been taken during a raid on a British Army arsenal in Ulster 3 years previously. Barry checked the handgun with the expertise of a long familiarity and then thrust it into his belt. He had felt naked and vulnerable for the short time that he was without the weapon, but he had reluctantly decided not to risk carrying it in the village. Now he tapped water into the kettle, and at the sound, a voice called through from the dim interior, "Is that you?"
"None other," Barry answered dryly, and the other man came through and stood in the doorway to the kitchen.
He was a thin, stooped man in his 50s, with a swollen, inflamed face of the very heavy drinker.
"Did you get it?"
His voice was husky and rough with whisky, and he had a seedy, run-down air, a day's stubble of grey hairs that grew at angles on the blotchy skin.
"It's all there, doctor."
"Don't call me that. I'm not a doctor anymore,"
the man snapped irritably.
"Oh, but you are a damned fine one. Ask the girls who dropped their bundles.
Leave me alone, damn you."
Yes, he had been a damn fine doctor, long ago, before the whiskey. Now, however, it was the abortions and the gunshot wounds of fugitives, and jobs like this one. He did not like to think about this one. He crossed to the sink and sorted through the packages.
"I asked you for adhesive tape," he said.
"They had none. I brought the bandage."
"I cannot..."
the man began, but Barry whirled on him savagely, his face darkening with angry blood.
"I've had a guts full of your whining. You should have brought what you needed, not sent me to get it for you. I did not expect the wound. You didn't expect anything but another dram of Jameson's, man. There's no adhesive tape. Now get on with it and tie the bitch's hand up with a bandage."
The older man backed away swiftly, picked up the packages, and shuffled through into the other room. Barry made the tea and poured it into the thick china mug, spooned in 4 spoons of sugar, and stirred noisily, staring out of the smeared panes. It was raining again. He thought that the rain and the waiting would drive him mad. The doctor came back into the kitchen, carrying a bundle of linen soiled with blood and the yellow ooze of sepsis.
"She's sick," he said. "She needs drugs, antibiotics. The finger, forget it," said Barry.
From the other room, there was a long, drawn-out whimper, followed by the incoherent gabble of a young girl, deep in the delirium induced by fever and hypnotic drugs.
"If she's not taken into proper care, I won't be responsible."
"You'll be responsible," Barry told him heavily. "I'll see to that."
The doctor dropped the bundle of linen into the sink and let the water run over it.
"Can I have a drink now?" he asked.
Barry made a sadistic display of consulting his watch.
"No, not yet," he decided.
The doctor poured soap flakes into the sink.
"I don't think I can do the hand," he whispered, shaking his head. "The finger was bad enough, but I can't do the hand."
"You'll do the hand," said Barry. "Do you hear me, you whiskey-guzzling old rack? You'll do the hand, and everything else I tell you to do."